This is the 24th of January and the second day on Emerson. I have a new approach. A new approach to self-reliance is working it out. The first paragraph, I found myself last time going into it in detail with the class. I fumbled. I spent too much time on it. With the pattern in mind of Franklin's Way to Wealth as a systematic discussion of prudence, and prudence is the point of view of Franklin's autobiography. It's the main point of view of it. Franklin thinks of himself as Poor Richard, and representing prudence in the autobiography. The other Franklins are scarcely in that, by and large. Just now, in running through self-reliance and thinking about it and making notes on a piece of paper, on one side intuition, on the other side society, ran through the essay and found all sorts of oppositions and terminology and examples and extensions of the meaning of society. The individual on the one hand and what's not the individual on the other, or what is the individual on one hand and what discourages the individual on the other. Now in class, I think it'd be interesting to work it out.
You know, I can't keep from picturing in my mind what the picture of your mind is when I open the discussion in here. Now, I've been trying to get into Thoreau, Emerson, in order to talk with you about him. And I come in here and I see your mind trying to get away from Emerson or the others in this newsprint, this so-called newspaper meditation that some of you seem to be addicted to. I couldn't very well ask you a question about Emerson right now, your mind not on Emerson. Now, I could ask you to restate the points that were made last time. But some of you, I wouldn't attempt that. I don't think your mind is on what we did in here last time. I'm reminded of some of my neighbors, the way they study the Sunday school lesson. The last thing Saturday night, or just before they get to Sunday school, or while they sing a hymn before they go into the Sunday school class, they run through the lesson. Now that lesson is based on one of the great pieces of literature, the Bible. I will say to you, right frankly, I'll say it to you personally. That I see no reason for you to register for this series of readings. If the readings don't mean anything to you privately, and if these readings are something that you can just open your book and pick up, that is new. One of the things I think anyone will notice about a university campus is that there's a high degree of sophistication on it. There is an abstractness and glibness about the intellect of even lower division students on a university campus that sometimes cannot be penetrated by any course, much less some of these dead writers 100 years ago. Now, I'm telling you directly what I have tried to tell you in good humor. I don't want to come in here in the morning, any morning, and see you buried in a newspaper. That may be your individual rights as citizens or students. But I want to condemn it as strongly as I can as your instructor. My object, my responsibility, my function here is to open up these writers for you. If you get off on what to me is ostensibly a tangent in the discussion, you can get back on the straight path. It's not what I tell you. My greatest aid to you can be in the sort of climate of opinion to talk with you in an open sort of way. I can't open up a question when I have all the obstructions. Unless you have Emerson on your mind, unless he penetrates your mind, there is nothing I can do about you and Emerson in this course. If you get anything at all out of this class worth getting, you have got to push aside all these obstacles that clutter your mind. Your minds are cluttered. That is the state of existence in our time. Our minds are so cluttered we cannot think. You think your mind works, but it doesn't pursue anything. Your mind is bombarded from so many directions, even with an act of will and perseverance. It's almost impossible for you to read one of these writers and make contact with the writer. Now that's how difficult it is. Now last time we talked about one paragraph, and it's something that I had never done before. It was totally fresh. And I was talking to you. We were talking back and forth in here. And I thought about that. I've thought about it ever since. The new light in which it has put all this material. And I've known this a long time. I've known it in a general way. Now, open your books to the first paragraph, and let me just bring it to your mind again. You see, I said to you, now this, you see, I got from the book. I read this in an introduction to Emerson one time, that in this first sentence, Emerson states the point of his lifelong interest. Now, there's no way you could know that unless you've done all this work before. I read the other day some verses written by an eminent painter which were original and not conventional. Now, there are the opposition. Now, I sat down at the office after I got back last time, and I kept thinking about it. Here is the opposition. Now, just use an ordinary sheet of paper and just scratch it in. This is all I did. See, I just scratched it in pencil. And let's put down some of these oppositions that he's talking about on the hunch that he is trying to make clear some insight of his about the individual. Now, you can help me now. Original and conventional. Now, what's another pair of oppositions? We were saying last time. Yes, Susan? Yes. Now, that's a good one. That's a good one. It's right there in the first paragraph. Please. Where is that? It's here. It's here. What lines are you thinking about? Or you think about the next paragraph or so? Huh? It's all right. That's over. Yes. That's a little farther on. Can be in this too. Now that's just a start. Now, he doesn't talk about the intuition, and we mentioned that last time in this paragraph, but it's in the essay. Isn't that right? Where did you find the word intuition, Marilyn? That's later, wasn't it? Well, it's in here anyhow. Now, what's some more? Yes, yes. And what happens to the first thought in order to make it what you might call the second thought? Yes, you can put it a little bit more formidably than that, if you would. Put a little more edge to it, if you want to. You were talking about that last time. I can't call your name. Francis. Kind of restate your view of that. Yes. Tone down. Go ahead.
make it stronger. Go ahead, go ahead.
So like the idea of sublimation and channeling your energy into the right path, well, to me, that's what the ego does with the less thoughts and energy into the right direction. And so the
mm-hmm.
Could you make it a little stronger? You put it in general terms. Kind of paraphrase that, put in your own words. Now, this is more than I ever got out of this paragraph. I didn't know it was all here.
Your inmost thought, your secret, and I use the term latent conviction. You fall over it, think about it, and in due time, it will form.
I never had any idea. I've read that a number of times, but I never had any idea what he meant by that. And I think that's something, I think that's on the right track. The inmost becomes the outmost, and what I am, you see, what I am privately, I am publicly too. And I see I'm I'm just intrigued by this. Now let's run ahead. Now that gleam of light, you remember? Now let me ask you this question. Just in passing, then we'll go ahead. Is what he's saying mean that that the individual thought is not really thought, is not systematic thought? If it's systematic, then this is not what he's talking about? Can it be systematic? Systematic? Can it be... It can be logical and organized,
right.
Like his essay. Now, let me tell you, I want to pick you up on that. I've been picked up on that myself. I said one time to the one of the professors here who was going to take my class, I had to be out. I said, well, just go through it and give his give the organization of his essay. Well, he said, I'd love to do that if I knew what the organization was of Emerson's essay. You know, I never thought about that before. There is no organization. What is it? Now, he picked me up on that, just something off on, you see. And he just pushed me back on my heels. I couldn't say a word, you know. There's not any. So that thought is not organized or systematic in his view. Yes. You just know certain things and you can't explain how. Well, now, where would you get in? Where would you get in the university, you see, with that principle? Well, I mean it. Where would this get you in the university? You couldn't get through C3 or C2 or C1 or C-1, could you? So that if you take an Emersonian approach, you see, it would disrupt your whole academic program. Self-trust
He uses that term there a little later. Don't you know we mentioned that yesterday? Self-trust, trust thyself, every heart vibrates to that. And I told you that was a tricky thing. Then he says society is against us. I see. And then he says, like we said before, whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. Now, I want to go into that paragraph with you. He who would gather mortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must explore if it be goodness. Now, that's a far-reaching statement. He must explore. Whose word can he take for it? You see? He must explore if it be goodness. Nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. Absolve you to yourself, and you shall have the suffrage of the world, and so forth. I remember an answer which, when quite young, I was prompted to make to a valued advisor who would want to importune me with the doctrines of the dear old church, dear old doctrines of the church, on my saying, "What have I to do with the sacredness of tradition if I live from within?" My friend suggested, "But these impulses may be from below, not from above." Now that undermines all he said, that these products of intuition, these first thoughts, may all be erroneous. Or to put it in these terms, they may be from below, from the devil, and not from above. Now, who's to decide? Now, look, his resolution of that question is cavalier. I replied, "They do not seem to me to be such. But if I am the devil's child, then I'll make the most of it." Now, you know the most famous case in history that works out this same principle? One of the most famous cases in history, not Socrates, I'm not thinking of him, and some of those. Joan of Arc. You know how it applies to Joan of Arc? You read psychology. Joan of Arc. They did not deny that Joan of Arc heard her voices. But they did reserve the authority to determine whether those voices were from below or above. And society and the central government in any, that's not medieval Europe, in any society, society will retain the last word. So now what's Emerson going to do? Well, now there you are. Now let's see. "No law can be sacred to me but the law of my own nature. Good and bad are but names very readily transferable to this or that. The only right is what is after my constitution. The only wrong, what is against it." Now, you see, that's treasonable, heretical. Help me out, you see. You let me struggle for words. Just stand up here and struggle. And you think I won't help me.
Can't you help me out? It's treasonable. That's against the country. It's heretical. It's against the church. It's, can't you help me out? Make it a little stronger. Stan, you've got a good vocabulary. What is it in the army? In the navy, it's mutinous. Yes, yes, that's mutinous. A man is to carry himself in the presence of all opposition as if everything were titular and ephemeral but he. I'm ashamed to think how easily we capitulate to badges and names, to large societies and dead institutions. Every decent and well-spoken individual affects and sways me more than is right. I ought to go upright and vital and speak the rude truths at all times. If malice and vanity wear the coat of philanthropy, shall that pass? If an angry bigot, now look here what he gets into. He switched now to abolition. If an angry bigot assumes this bountiful cause of abolition and comes to me with his last news from Barbados, why should I not say to him, go love thy infant? Now that's pretty good. Love thy woodchopper. Be good-natured and modest. Have that grace and never varnish your hard, uncharitable ambition with this incredible tenderness for black folks 1,000 miles away. Now, the assumption there is safe. A love of mankind is sometimes, don't you know, what dear Hopper say, goes along with distrust of your neighbor. And that's his assumption here. That he don't want to substitute this love of abolition 1,000 miles away, but to be good to your plumber or to your woodchopper or your children. I think that's well taken. Isn't he on solid ground? Thy love far is spite at home. Rough and graceless would be such greeting, but truth is handsomer than affection of love, affectation of love. Your goodness must have some edge to it, else it is none. The doctrine of hatred must be preached as a counteraction of the doctrine of love when that fumes and whines. Now look, I shun father, mother, and brother when my genius calls me. This may be a whim. And then again, you see this class of persons as a class of person to whom all by natural affinity I am bound and sold. For them I will go to prison if need be. But your miscellaneous popular charities, now this is like the cause of abolition and philanthropy. He has philanthropy on his mind here. At this time, you see, philanthropy was uppermost. You know what Tom Jones is about? Tom Jones, a novel? What's it about? Jones did all sorts of bad things, but he was warm-hearted. That's that feeling of philanthropy, that men are good. As long as men are good, they can do no great evil. Now that's, in a way, sort of what he's thinking about here. And then he says, though I confess with shame these relief societies, I sometimes succumb and give the dollar. It is a wicked dollar that he gives to the abolition societies or the relief societies. It's a wicked dollar, which by and by I shall have the manhood to withstand. And you see, he's in the same position as Thoreau at the end of Walden. No, at the end of the first section that he calls economy. Do you remember the position he's in there? In that first section that he calls economy. Do you remember that position? That's right. Yes, he takes a fairly rigid view of it, but what he means is that people will judge him this way. That he is
running away from his responsibility of doing good to his neighbors and helping them in their need. And he says that's wicked to think like that. That's a great cause in his time. So he is clashing, you see, with the main movement of his time, I'd say. He's clashing with it. Philanthropy, relief societies, abolition. That's just one of two dozen doing good. Go ahead, Sam. Yes, a little poverty. I'm not sure that he espouses poverty, but he sees the hardship of property, doesn't he? That's the trouble with the farmers. They have all that property, and he doesn't know whether they ride the horse or the horse rides them. Now, in my case, I know who's riding which. My cows are riding me. They work me to death. I sometimes think I would love to just sit down and rest and look around the scenery. But whenever I think that, I think, well, these cows have got to have a little tension. First time we have hit it off. This first time I felt at home in here, as if I'm getting anywhere. Now here we've got a little background together. We have two writers, two books. Now we're getting into Emerson, and that first statement of his sort of set me off. And I see those oppositions. And it sort of got into my mind. And I looked a little farther, and as I looked, it got more into my mind. And it seems to me that that goes through this whole essay, so that you do not have a logical organization of the essay, but you have a thought carried through it. Now, look, if that stays in my mind, that will go through the whole series of readings. All our readings, if that can get into your mind, you can pursue that. Through all our reading, and I'm getting to the point, I'm not really good-natured about this, or you can clutter your mind with all sorts of hindrances and bring them here to class and sit here and look at them right through this discussion. And then at the end, you'll raise a question. What have I got out of this class? It's so much easier for so many, even in a university, to warm a bench than it is to let one all thought enter the mind and stay there. The representatives over at Tallahassee say, look at these great institutions. We have the finest professors. We have the most promising students. And the professors are dumb and the students don't listen. One little thought picked up from this essay can transform your whole life and make something of it, and you're not wishy-washy anymore.
two things are in my mind this morning. I don't usually talk like this in any course. But I got into this little essay, and I see an Emerson in a new way. And I come into here, and a good large number of you coming in here and reading newspapers. And the two are just disturbing me. I want you to get into these things. If there's something here, I want you to get into it. And I'll do whatever I can to push aside those hindrances. Now, let me tell you, let me cool off a little bit. And you collect your thoughts and make some notes and let me check the roll and look around here. You see, we've got to transact a little business. Now, you see, you see I'm sort of upset. And so don't push me when I'm pushing you. Don't you push me, you see. You wait a little, I cool off, and then you can push me. I'll let you have your turn. I also, when I transacted business, I also said, now you've got to look forward to Hawthorne as well as look backward to Thoreau. And it came to me right then. I cut this tape off. This came to me. I didn't know what was going to happen. It came to me. It came to me. Thoreau, where is Thoreau now in relation to this first paragraph in Self-Reliance? Where is he? And then it came to me, and I presented it to you. Where is Thoreau at Walden in relation to all these opposites, you see, of the first paragraph of Self-Reliance? You see, he goes there not to live cheaply, but to face life and see if it is life and if it is worth living. And see what he's doing. He's trying to get away from these things that Emerson's talking about, that he ought to get away from, and then see if there is anything in these first thoughts and the intuitions and the things that come to him. So, you see, you pursue this subject. Now at 4:43 is the end of the first day of Emerson and the beginning of the second day of Emerson. This is, I suppose half of it still on the Self-Reliance, and then we begin on the American Scholar. And I'm interested to see, as I listen to the tape again, just what did take place today. Interested in what I say. I'm going to see if I can get one and sit out here, and whenever you talk, I'll turn it on. If you don't object, then I forget what you say all the time. And sometimes I don't quite follow what you say, and it seems pretty awkward to you, I know. It seemed to me last time I've got the best insight into this article, the Self-Reliance that I've ever had, and it is came from our discussion that there is no organization, there is no systematic thought in Emerson, and I gave you an authority for that, the member of the staff who is going to take my place one day when I had to be away. And I had somehow felt all along that there was some organization. Now, in here, I think you have you've seen that already. Now, how much you do it will depend upon what value you set on what we're doing here. Your best preparation, I think, will be picking up cues from one class to another from our discussions. Now, you see, those cues are not suggestions that I give you from my notes or from reading in the bibliography. It's from getting into the material itself. Now, if you were on your toes, as the coaches might say this morning, you would have worked out that point from last time and gone through self-reliance, seeing how this one idea organizes the essay, and so much of it as Emerson's struggles for not so much clarifying what he's trying to say is making it clear to himself. Now, I somehow get the feeling when I listen to lectures and sermons and read articles and books and all that the answers have already been arrived at. They're there. And my cue is to find out what the answer is. I don't think that is the approach in Emerson. I think he himself is raising the question which he states. You know, a statement is a question. In philosophical terms, a statement is actually a point of to examine. A philosophical statement is a point to examine. So he starts with that philosophical statement, you might say. That there is this profound difference, basic difference, you see, between the original and conventional. And in his essay, he's inquiring what the difference is. And it may be that those opposites that he works out in here help him see what he's looking for. Now, I don't know that I need to do much with that. I called your attention to see to what he says about the nonchalance of poetry. You see that? Okay, let's just run through it. I don't want to be cavalier about this. I want to work with you on it. I never can find a place. He says the right attitude, you see, is the nonchalance of boys. Now, that's the right attitude. And, but the man is, as it were, clapped into jail by his consciousness. As soon as he has once asked or spoken and so forth, watched by the sympathy of the hatred of others, and then he gives you the other side of that. Then he does it, then he makes this strong statement, you see, on society. Well, now, just in passing, you see, what is society? I don't believe a person should just say, I know right off what society is. Society has so many forms. One form is a class organization. It may be that any organization is society, is it? I don't know. He doesn't quite say. He says society and lumps everything together. You can interrupt me anytime you please. I thought I was such a whirlwind here. I don't think you would say anything all morning. You never really face the question, what is society? But you use it all the time. That's one of your assumptions, which is so indefinite, it doesn't really keep you on safe ground. I should talk a little. Your attitude. You mean to say that society is something that anybody knows what it is? Society is other people. I don't think that's what society is to you. In other words, I don't think you know what society is. I think you use it, but I don't think you actually know how you use it. You understand? I'm just talking with you now. I don't think it's other people. Something, just anything that's not me. Go ahead. Customs and traditions. Now, customs and traditions, that's society. What custom do you have in mind? I'm going to leave it at that. See, you can't ask me my view of it because I ask you first. must be, you see in the next paragraph, he must be a nonconformist, you see. And then he has this historic case of Joan of Arc where the individual is pitted against society. And the question is there, ultimately, who's right? Can the individual say, this is right, and I'll stick to it? The individual cannot do that, unless he wants to be burned in the fire. And he won't be burned in the fire now, but he, except in a figurative way, be burned, you see, and he is. You see, you can be burned all along the line, can't you? You don't have to go to the federal government or the Supreme Court or any court for that matter. You can be burned all along the line by society, and we don't know what that is. And in this same long paragraph, which has no form whatever, no idea, no center of idea as far as I can see, he takes a swing at the relief societies, the benevolent societies, all of them. And he says they would do better. You remember that? And he says, well, we don't know. We don't know that much about him. I don't.
Well, I mean, why are we studying? You said that we should not take this course knowledge we weren't interested in. I just wondered why we're studying him.
Well, you raise a question. If you'd make a statement, I'll help you pursue it. You want me to make a statement and you help me pursue it? You help me pursue it?
Yeah.
Well, I think I've already made one. The framework of our discussion of Emerson is the same thing we had in Franklin. In the way of Wells, he defined his own point of view in the autobiography. That is, he's representing himself in the autobiography as Poor Richard. Now, we read Walden, and there's so many loose ends. And what we say about Walden is that he studied nature, and he went away from society, and all those little things, you see, that actually are impertinent. And we're looking at Emerson now to see if he'll give us the same systematic view that we got before. Now, you remember that? Yes, ma'am.
What makes you mad when people say, well, look at Skip Gold Emerson, he said he should go away from society, but he because you don't have to be off in the woods to keep from having society turn you around and follow along with it. It's just a matter of
you can study. Well, I'd say that's sort of a nonconformist attitude.
Right.
Or
C2, C3, any of them. I didn't mean to pick out any one. Modified function. Don't raise questions. Make statements. Well, how'd you modify it in light of what you read in here?
Well, I mean, it sounds great. I mean, you know, you've got your conformance and all the way he says it, but I just wanted to think.
All right, now after class, you all go for a little while in the same direction and talk that over a little bit. And then when you get back next time, let me know what your state of mind. Yeah. You know this, excuse me, I beg your pardon. I don't blame her. The definition of nonconformist.
No, the definition of nonconformist is like a thing that you can
Now, let me tell you, in this, where we are talking about now, he's talking about the relief societies, the philanthropy, those societies. And he calls it, the money he gives to those relief societies, he calls a wicked dollar. And sometimes he says he'll have the fortitude not to do that. Now, what does he propose as the alternative? There's something better than that. He says, look at your book. What did he say? Don't you remember that?
I know he said he doesn't want to use any money to his problem.
Yes. What did he say? What? What did he say? About the experiment at Brook Farm, as I remember. And at Brook Farm, you see, they were experimenting with ways of living. One is without property and with daily labor and things they had on their mind. And Hawthorne found that the Brook Farm experiment just took his time. It was just an encumbrance, a hindrance to it. And that's in all of his stories. He writes that into all of his stories. And Emerson's doing the same thing here.
Now, I can't see to you just where his whole attitude towards the uplifting society is, the experiments. You'd have to get into that a little bit. Or you could... He was in on the Brook Farm thing, yes. He was the spokesman for it. He was in the dial. And a good number of interesting people in it, young people.
Well, what happened?
Well, it not supposed to work out. It lasted 2 or 3 years. That's pretty good, you know. Hang on to some little social experiments for that length of time. You'll have to look into that. You'll have to read up on that. But you almost have to read up on that to get into Emerson, at least this side of Emerson's thought. Yes. I see that point. Now here you see one of the next points. He says a foolish consistency, a consistency. A person is tied down consistency. You see, that's on one side. That's against the genius. Then he follows that and says a man, he supposes, cannot violate his own nature, but he does. And then a little longer, he talks about an institution. And he says, an institution is the length and shadow of one man. So that one man, you see, like in their time, he's going along with Carlyle's sort in heroes and hero worship in history. Carlyle at one time thought that Mohammed, you see, and a few of the great men, you see, determined our history. He changed later. In that little book in which he talks about the Abbot Samson and the election in the old medieval monastery, he's changed by then. But when he wrote the first book, he's thinking of history as being formed by great men. I mean, really great men, you see. And you see, Muhammad almost establishes a whole civilization. And an institution, then, is the length and shadow of one man. And he thinks of it as bad. Then, as he says in the next paragraph, let a man then know his worth and keep things under his feet. Let him not peep or steal or skulk up and down, you see. Then he talks about history. Our reading is mendicant and sycophantic. In history, our imagination plays a farce. And what he does here is the same thing as Thoreau does. He is thinking now about history, the study of history, and then our attitude towards royalty, and he shifts it. He still has a royalty, you see, but it's not the medieval royalty. And then he has a rather technical section on intuition, spontaneity, and he uses a term in the long paragraph that starts, the relations of the soul to the divine spirit. What page is that? Yes. Now that is the, and I think he uses the word there. If it's not, it's understood. Is a word that is in American history, colonial history, antinomian. You see, Anne Hutchinson was persecuted and exiled on account of what was called antinomian beliefs and conduct. So he feels that he's in that same tradition. And Joanna of Arc and Anne Hutchinson that you see, now here are two of his landmarks. And I think she's a good one. Now, I won't offer to tell you, explain all that. You can pursue that for any information you want. And he says then about religion, this should be plain enough. Yet see what strong intellects dare not yet hear God himself unless he speaks the phraseology that they are accustomed to, you see. Almost has to speak the phraseology of the New Testament, or in particular of St. Paul in the epistles and the letters. You see, before the Lord can't speak any other language than that, seems like. Or if he does, nobody wants to hear any other language than that, especially the members of the religious institutions. Unless the Lord speaks in the language of St. Paul, they can't hear, don't hear. And I can see that. I can see that. For instance, if you were to get up in the pulpit sometime and just start out the morning prayer, you know the first thing you'd do? You wouldn't just address the Lord and speak the things that you think ought to be done. If you did, you'd sound sort of hard. Now, you listen to some of the preachers, and they've got a marvelous rhetoric. It's beautiful. It's conventional. And you couldn't even touch it, not unless you work on it for 20 years. So, you see, that's what the Lord hears, that rhetoric. That's what he's saying. Now, there's an institution for you, see? That's what the religious institution might say, or the New Testament does for the religion. And the thing about it is, those who are most concerned are not scholars enough to know the difference. They themselves are victims of their own good intentions. But they're not the only ones. I have yet to find a university audience that could cut through an institution. And I have found no group of literary students who can work into the pure thought of a writer. In this essay, I just don't want to leave it. Oh, that's on, it's way over there. The populists think that your rejection of popular standard, what page is that? Is mere antinomian. You see, there's the term. He uses it. Oh. Now look what he says. He has 1, 2, 3, 4 in this, but that's still not very systematic. Look what he says about prayers. And our sympathy is just as base. We come to them who weep foolishly and sit down and cry for company instead of imparting to them truth and health and rough electric shocks. So that he even, you see, takes this religious institution, if you'd call it that, of prayer, and sees that in terms of